All right, let's take a look at Genesis. Genesis chapter 9. Genesis chapter 9. Verse 18 is where we left off. Genesis chapter 9, verse 18. The sons of Noah who went forth from the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Ham was the father of Canaan. Dum, da, dum, dum, dum. Right, the author is setting you up. He's letting you know there's something coming here, right? Canaan's got something to do with the next story. There's that framing device. Noah was the father of Shem, Ham, and Japheth. But Ham was the father of Canaan. That's obviously some important information for the next story, huh? These three were the sons of Noah, and from these the whole earth was peopled. Verse 20, Noah was the first tiller of the soil. He planted a vineyard, and he drank of the wine, and became drunk, and lay uncovered in his tent. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father, and told his two brothers outside. Then Shem and Japheth, the eldest and the youngest, took a garment and laid it upon both their brothers, their shoulders, and walked backward and covered the nakedness of their father. And their faces were turned away, and they did not see their father's nakedness. When Noah awoke from his wine and knew what his youngest son had done to him, he said, "Cursed be Canaan." Okay. As we were saying there, in verse 25, he said, "Cursed be Canaan. A slave of slaves shall he be." Now, what does Canaan have to do with the story? Where'd he come in? Well, his only connection to what we just heard is his father, Ham, right? So we have three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. The middle son, second oldest, saw his father's nakedness in his drunkenness, came out and told his brothers, which means he's, you know, making fun of dad. And the eldest and the youngest came in and covered their father's nakedness. When he awoke from his wine, he said, "Cursed be Canaan. A slave of slaves shall he be." This is the son of Ham. So what's going on in the story? Well, who is Shem? Shem is the eldest son of Noah. He is the father of the Shemites. The Shemites, right? Shem. You lose the SH in Hebrew when you go into the Greek, and so you end up with just the Semites. His name is Sem in the Greek. So the Semites is the father of all Semitic peoples. And then you have Ham, the father of the Hamites, and then Japheth is the father of the Japhethites. We'll talk more about it in a second. So Ham's son Canaan ends up being cursed. What's going on here? Well, the rabbis and the fathers of the church read this as we read it here. Simply that Ham disrespected his father in front of his older brother and youngest brother, did not care for his father in charity as he should with his father's drunkenness, and should have acted differently. Whereas Shem and Japheth covered their father's names. They cared for him. They took care of the situation and honored their father. Well, then why is Canaan cursed? Well, the curse is from the father to the son to the, you know, third and fourth generation. And so you have a cursing going on here from that. There is another interpretation, however. I don't necessarily recommend it to you, but you should be aware of it because it is out there. A lot of commentaries will talk about it. And there's a lot of support for it. There's a lot of interesting peculiarities about the story that seem to led to another interpretation. And that interpretation goes like this. The nakedness of the father, to look upon the nakedness of your father in Hebrew, if you look at Leviticus 18, means to have relations with your mother or to have relations with someone who is near of kin of your father. So your father's aunt. Or your father's sister, for example, you cannot have relations with your aunt because she is your father's nakedness, as your father's sister, right? You cannot have relations with your mother because she is your your father's nakedness. You cannot have relations with your sister because she is your father's nakedness. Okay, this is in Leviticus 18. Based upon that language there, to look upon the nakedness as an euphemism for sexual relations in Leviticus, you take that text back and look into this text through that lens, and then it raises a question. Is there something else going on here? It's also, when we look at the next version of the story, when we come to the Lot story with his two daughters, again, I'll mention this, because if you look at the cycles of events here, we're going through cycles in Genesis. We saw the first cycle, Adam and Eve, and the fruit in the garden, and consuming the fruit, and then cursing, blessing and cursing. The same thing here, you now have the second version of this. You have the new Adam, that is Noah, plants a vineyard, you have fruit, he eats of the fruit, there's a problem, and now you have curses. In fact, the cycle continues, just like in the tail end of the fall story. You had the descendancy of Adam through these two sons, chapters 4 and 5. As soon as the story's over, you're going to have the descendancy of Noah in chapters 10 and 11. So you can, and again, the cycles, it's quite obvious that the cycle is intended. And when we come to the Lot story, we're going to see, again, something parallel to Noah and Lot. There was Adam to Noah and then Noah to Lot. There's a bunch of this. These cycles happening where you can see parallelisms. And so when you get to the Lot story, you look back again on this story, and again, it raises some questions. Those who hold to the theory would suggest this, that what happened is Ham, not being the eldest son, and therefore not going to be the king or the head of all humanity when Noah dies, Ham decides to usurp his elder brother's authority by having relations with his mother. How would that have any effect on this? Again, back into that culture there. In that ancient world, when a man had wives and he died, the harem of his father was inherited by his son. Not for sexual interest, okay, or anything like that. It was to maintain the treaties, because the wives of a king were the pawns in the treaties between the nations. So when Solomon, for example, had a treaty with Egypt, he married the daughter of Pharaoh, 1 Kings chapter 4. I can give example after example of this. This is where Solomon ended up with 1,000 wives, right? Where did he pick these up? At the local bar? No, these are all daughters of the harems of the kings from the nations around with whom he has treaties. Jezebel in the north, a Sidonian princess, right? Israel had a treaty with Sidon, and therefore the king of Sidon, his daughter from the harem, they had multiple wives because they had these treaties, and so they had lots of kids, lots of boys, lots of girls. What do you do with the girls? Well, the girls end up as being used as these living treaties in a certain sense. All right, so because of that, and because of that inheritance of a father to a son of the harem to maintain the treaties, maintain the harem, then there is this theory that maybe this is what's going on here. Think of the story of David and Absalom, and Absalom chases David out of Jerusalem. You know what happens, of course, on the roof of the palace with David's wives. So with that in mind, then the theory would be that Ham had relations with his father's wife, that is his mother, in order to usurp the authority of Shem. And then that would make sense of why Canaan, the offspring, is cursed. Take it or leave it. You can do what you want with it. It is not a theory that appears anywhere among the rabbis or among the fathers of the church. And when you find that situation, I recommend significant caution. Right? These different theories, ideas come and go throughout the history of interpretation, and so this may be one that has come and may eventually go. But you should at least be aware of it, because you'll find it in commentaries. I'll talk about it again when we hit the other passages that seem to support the theory. But in the end, it raises sometimes more questions than it answers. For example, what is Shem and Japheth then doing with covering of the father's nakedness? All right, chapter 9, verse 23. Cursed be Canaan. Shem here, of course, is blessed, and Japheth gets a secondary blessing. That'll be important in the next story. The episode concludes with chapter 10, verse 1. These are the generations of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Sons were born to them after the flood. Okay, so you see that? You get that framing device again. You get that same framing device, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. But now you get the little detail that's for the next story. They're no longer interested in Canaan's the son of Ham. That was for the last story. Now they're going to give you, and by the way, sons were born to them after the flood. And then now you're going to get the story about the sons. You see how that works? All right, so in chapter 10, we hear about the descendancy of Noah. Three different lines of humanity. The first one, the author wants to tell you about and then get rid of it. He doesn't want to talk about it much because it's not relevant for the rest of the story. The sons of Japheth are listed in verses 2 through 5, a little short paragraph. Japheth had sons. Here they are. Let's move on. And then he wants to get into what he sees is more important, and that is the sons of Ham versus the sons of Shem. The reason why the author is interested in this is the primary enemies of the people of God through Abraham, of course, are mainly those coming from the line of Ham. Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, we could go on, right? The Philistines. So these are the descendants of Ham, and the author wants to focus in on them. It may also have to do with the cycle that we talked about. When we saw the first part of this cycle, after the curses, you had the descendancy of Adam, which originally three sons, but you end up with only two, right? You have Cain and Seth, two lines. And so we're going to get two lines now that the author wants to talk about. Verse 6, the sons of Ham, Cush, Egypt, Put, Canaan, the sons of Cush, Saba, Havilah, etc. If you look at the line, the names, like I said, you're looking at all the enemies of Israel we're going to see in the Old Testament. And then, just like you had at the end of chapter 4, after the end of telling us the story of the line of Cain, don't confuse Cain and Canaan, of course. Here now, we get to the story of the line of Shem, the parallel to Seth. And so then we hear about a few of the descendants from Shem. But Shem's genealogy is broken. It's split into a first and a second half by a little story that is inserted into it called the story of the Tower of Babel, which is exactly where the story of the flood is inserted, a much longer version, into the descendancy of Seth. Remember, Seth is the father of Noah. You have all the offspring. You come to Noah, then you have the flood story, and then now we got the Noah descendancy continuing. Here, in parallel to that, you have the exact same thing happening. You now have the line of Shem, and then it's interrupted by this little episode, the story of the Tower of Babel, which indicates to you the author wants you to see the story of the flood and the story of the Tower of Babel in parallel. And in fact, in case you missed it, he frames the whole story with the word flood. Look what it says there in chapter 10, verse 32. These are the families, the sons of Noah. Go up to chapter 10, verse 31. Here's a little framing device. These are the sons of Shem by their families, their languages, their lands, and their nations. Languages. We know something's going on. So then look at verse 32. These are the families, the sons of Noah, according to their genealogies in their nations, from these nations spread across the earth after the flood. After the flood. That's a framing device. Look at the end of the flood of the Tower of Babel story. Chapter 11, verse 10. These are the descendants of Shem. When Shem was 100 years old, he became the father of Arpad, 2 years after the flood. You see that? The word flood framing the Tower of Babel story. So it's framed from a larger structural standpoint and is set in parallel to the flood story. But in case that wasn't clear, the author even frames the story with the word flood to begin the end. Why does he want us to see this story in light of the flood? Well, we'll see here. Now, chapter 11, verse 1. Now, the whole earth had one language and few words. And as men migrated from the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. This is the land of Babylon, Mesopotamia. And they said to one another, come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly. And they had bricks for stone and bitumen for mortar. And they said, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens. And let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. Sons of men. Do you remember that? You had the sons of God versus the daughters of men, right? So there's a problem here. So you have the sons of men had built. These are the non-covenantal people of God, the sons of men. And the Lord said, behold, they are one people, and they have all one language, and this is only the beginning of what they shall do. So he scattered them, right? The original purpose was to scatter. They're supposed to inhabit the earth, fill the earth, and here they're staying in one spot. But the bigger problem is they're trying to build a tower to the heavens. Build a tower to the heavens. Now, why in the world do they want to build a tower? Why do you build a tower? Well, if this is in parallel to the flood story, then we may have an answer. If you look at the ancient Mesopotamian flood stories, there are versions of the flood story, as you know, in the creation story, among the pagan Mesopotamian peoples and around. In one of the flood stories, all the flood stories, the gods are trying to wipe out humanity. They either created them accidentally, or they just appeared somehow on the earth, like, you know, cockroaches, where they come from. And then they're trying to get rid of them, trying to stamp them out. Extermination. And so the flood is an attempt to get rid of humanity because they're just too much trouble. They create too much noise. The gods can't sleep at night anymore because the people are too noisy. The very comical versions of the flood in the Mesopotamian pagan peoples. But they try to wipe out mankind, but one man outsmarts the gods by climbing to the highest mountain and going up to the top of the highest tree. And the floods come up and cover the hills and all the dirt, but they don't cover the top of the tree. And so therefore, this man stays alive. Then when the waters recede, from him, all humanity is repopulated. Now, the author of that story isn't so concerned by the fact that there's only one of them, so you can't really repopulate if there's only one man. But these are pagan stories, okay? They're not too interested in rationality. But what's interesting is that parallels the man survived the flood by going above, by outsmarting the gods and going above the water level. So it may be, and this is just a possibility, it may be that here in the story, this may be a hint at what's going on. Who knows? That these individuals are, and that the author wants us to understand, what they're trying to do, they don't trust God, they're not in covenantal relationship, they're called the sons of men, and they don't trust him therefore, and so therefore, they don't believe the promise that was before that God would never again put a flood upon the earth. And so they put a tower to the heavens, hoping in the case the flood comes, they will outsmart the God. Maybe. Who knows what it is? Chapter 11, now the genealogy of Shem continues. The genealogy of Shem continues. Just like the genealogy of Seth continued after the flood, the genealogy of Shem continues after the Tower of Babel story. And most importantly for us is we come to the story of Abram. Now, Abram, if we're talking about these cycles, if you're interested in this stuff, Abram is the Noah parallel. Just like we had the man Noah, who was the one through whom God would save humanity, so Abraham is the one through whom God is going to save humanity, the new covenantal character. The covenant was with Noah. Now God's made a covenant with Abraham. For the sake of all the nations, witnesses. All right. So then in verse 27, now these are the descendants of Terah. Terah was the father of Abram, Nahor, Haran. And Haran was the father of Lot. Haran died before his father Terah in the land of his birth in the Ur of the Chaldeans. And Abraham, Nahor, took wives, and the name of Abram's wife was Sarai, and the name of Nahor's wife, Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah, Isaac. Now, Sarai was barren. She had no child. So there's a problem, right? It's a theme we're going to see later on. Terah took Abram, his son, and Lot, the son of Haran, the grandson, and Sarai, the daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife, and they went forth together from Ur of the Chaldeans. Now, why did they go forth from Ur of the Chaldeans? If you read at the end of the book of Joshua, the end of the book of Joshua tells us that these people were pagans. All this region was pagan. They were worshiping the foreign gods. And God, the one true God, the creator of the universe, called Abram, in the Genesis story, called Abram and his father, his family, forth from Ur of the Chaldees to live in accordance with the will of the one true God. Chapter 12, now the Lord said to Abram, go forth from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land I will show you. So where do they go? They go from Ur of the Chaldees up to Haran. This is the top of the Fertile Crescent. And then now from Haran, they're being called down to Palestine. And I will make of you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and by you all the families of the earth shall bless themselves. So this is an extremely important passage. In the New Testament, this is the passage of Genesis that is most quoted. And the focus of the authors in the New Testament on this passage is on this. Through you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Verse 3. This is why Matthew's gospel begins with telling us that Jesus is not only a son of David, but a son of Abraham. Because at the end of Matthew's gospel, he's going to say, go out and baptize all the nations. Right? All nations. So the call of Abram is for the sake of the nations. People will often look at the story as if God is choosing one man from all of humanity through whom he'll create his own special people. The rest, to hell with them. No, that's Calvinism. No, that's not the Judeo-Christian tradition. That is not the Orthodox faith. God wills that all men be saved. Right? And St. Paul says in 1 Timothy 2:4. All men be saved. This is God's will. So he calls Abram for the sake of those from whom he called them. He calls each one of us in our life for the sake of those around us. So think of a prophet, the prophet Isaiah, or the prophet John the Baptist, any of the prophets. He calls them from the people, for the people. And so the same thing happens here with Abram. And of course, we know the rest of the story. Verse 4, Abram went on as the Lord had told him, and Lot went with him. We keep hearing about Lot because he'll be important in the story. And he went into the land of Canaan. Look at verse 8. Thence he removed to the mountain on the east of Bethel and pitched his tent with Bethel on the west, I on the east, and there he built an altar to the Lord and called on the name of Yahweh. And Abram journeyed on, still going toward the Negev. So he's heading down. He's come through Palestine, and he hits the Negev. What's the Negev? That's that southern region, south of Judea, the original Judea. When they inhabited the land, remember that the Dead Sea, Sea of Galilee, Judah originally gets this area. And later on, it gets the whole southern region when Simeon disappears. But this area right here is called the Negev, that southern dry region. There's nothing you can do out there except raise a couple sheep and some goats. Very hot, very dry. This is serious desert. So he heads through the land of Canaan, through what we call Judea, and that It's not too bad. Somewhere is high desert, the lowlands. You get lakes and things, you get some water. But then you head down south, you get to the Negev, there's nothing there. It's dry. And when he gets there's a famine in the land. Well, I couldn't see that one coming. Of course, he's in a famine land, right? There's nothing there today. Still a famine. Now he has to make a choice. He's in the desert, he's in the wilderness. And now he has to choose which way will he go. Will he go back to the land that God promised to him, or will he go down to Egypt? What does this story have to do with the rest of the stories? The book of Genesis is not a camcorder, or there's not a man walking along recording what's happening in some sort of sterile version of history. The book of Genesis is composed for a particular audience. And the audience for which this is composed is not Abraham. Abraham's a man in the story. So the book is composed for an audience that is much later than the stories that we're seeing. Well, what is that audience? Well, according to the rabbinic and patristic tradition, the book of Genesis, in the form we have it, at least for the most part, comes from the hand of Moses in some way or another. Moses being the author of the Torah, the Pentateuch. Now, how much of this predates Moses? Probably a lot of Genesis comes from oral traditions that are before Moses. In fact, if you look at the book of Genesis carefully, you can see strands from the tribe of Levi, strands from the tribe of Benjamin or from Judah, of oral traditions that eventually become this text we call the book of Genesis. So why are we concerned about whether Abraham wants to go from into the promised land or into Egypt? Well, this is the problem of the book of Exodus. This is the problem of the time of Moses. Are the people of God who find themselves in a desert land going to return to Egypt, or are they going to go where God has promised, the land that he's promised to them? Abraham goes to Egypt. And when he's there, he's afraid that he's going to get killed. He's afraid he's going to be killed. He's afraid because the Egyptians are polygamists, polytheists as well, but polygamists. And therefore, he's afraid he'll die. Right? As I mentioned to you before, polygamy and murder always go hand in hand in the Old Testament. You'll often hear someone say, "Oh, polygamy, it was okay back then." No, you'll never find an example of polygamy where it's shown in a good light. Even among Abraham, the patriarchs, when they engage in polygamy, there's problems immediately in the story. The author's trying to show you this is not what God intended from the beginning. This is what Jesus says, of course, in Matthew chapter 19, right? Yes, he allowed you to divorce your wives, but this was not the case from the beginning. But man, God is joining together, no man put asunder, right? Male and female. It wasn't male, female, 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 female. It wasn't Adam, Eve, and Susie and Janet. No, it was Adam and Eve. One man, one woman. So the first time we saw polygamy and murder, the line of Cain, right? Here we come, we encounter polygamy and the fear of murder, at least in Egypt, coming from the line of Ham. This is that parallel in the structure. So he goes there, and of course, God protects him and protects Sarah, and she's eventually returned to him. And Abram leaves Egypt with much wealth. I say, hey, that worked out so well. Hey, it wasn't too bad, was it? Imagine having your wife taken from you and being afraid of being killed, right? I'm sure he didn't sleep very well while he was in Egypt. So this is the story as St. Ephrem sees, St. Ephrem, the doctor of the church, St. Ephrem the Syrian, sees this as a type, an image of what will happen to the people of Israel in Egypt, right? When they will kill the male children but let the female children live. And then they will eventually leave, though, Egypt with great wealth. Does this mean they should go to Egypt? No, doesn't mean you should go to Egypt. Abram shouldn't go to Egypt, but he does. What it does show you is that God is in control, that God will look after Abram even while he is in Egypt and brings him forth back out of that place. He doesn't leave him there. And so the same thing happens to the people of Israel. They eventually go down into Egypt because of a famine. at the end of the book of Genesis. They're going to go in there because of a famine, but they're going to be brought out by the hand of God. They need to go through the wilderness to the promised land. Chapter 13, Abram went up from Egypt, and he and his wife and all that he had, Lot with him, to the Negev, back into the desert land. So this is, you can see now the people of Israel leaving. And he's in the Negev. Then he went up to Canaan. Now he's in Bethel and Ai, the same place where he began. The author shows you. Didn't get him anywhere, right? Went all the way down there. He had to come back. Stay where you are. But then we hear about Abram and Lot's shepherds fighting because there's just not enough room for them, not enough land for the sheep. And so Abram says to Lot, we are kinsmen, we are brothers. In the Hebrew, literally, brothers, achim. So let us not have strife. Let us not fight. Look, the land is before us. Wherever you go that way, I'll go this way. Okay, let's not have a problem. Now, what should Lot do? Lot has a choice. Lot could tell his shepherds to close their mouth and figure out how to get along with Abram's shepherds. But instead, he journeys east, right? He takes off. He looks at the land of the Jordan, and he sees it as well-watered. Oh, very nice, like the garden of the Lord. So he takes off, and he goes east. So if you can't figure out there's a problem, the author hints of the problem by the fact he's leaving Abram. You don't want to do that. He's heading to the region of Sodom and Gomorrah. You know that's not going to work out well. And then he tells you Lot journeyed east, verse 11. Remember, journeying east is the wrong direction in the book of Genesis, in the whole Pentateuch, in fact. Journeying west is the right direction. Abram dwelt in the land of Canaan while Lot dwelt in the cities of the valley. Now moved his tent as far as Sodom. Now the men of Sodom were wicked, great sinners against the Lord. So now he tells you, in case you didn't figure out, this was a really bad idea for Lot. By the way, the author of Genesis will never tell you when a character is doing something wrong. They won't say, and this was wrong, or this was a sin, or this was a really bad move. They'll just show it to you. They assume you can read the text. You're a good, reader of a story. These are great stories. Look at verse 14. The Lord said to Abram, after Lot had separated from him, lift up your eyes. Look, north, south, east, west. Walk this earth, north, south, east, west. This land is yours. So as St. Ephraim, again, the Syrian, says, this is God blessing the land in the sign of the cross by Abraham walking the sign of the cross on the land. Chapter 14, we hear about proto-World War I. Okay, so this is a massive war. All the nations in the region get involved. In the midst of the war, Lot is taken captive. Verse 13 and 14. So it says that Abram gathered the men of his house, 318 of them, and went in pursuit as far as Dan. Now, who are these guys? Well, these men, these are the servants he has bought while he was in Haran and it acquired in Egypt. Abraham's keeping slaves. Again, some people say, you see, slavery's okay. Look, Abraham had slaves, right? He had 318 of them. So I guess it's okay if I have slaves to pick my cotton in Alabama. No. No. Because try giving your 318 slaves in Alabama shotguns and see if they'll go out to war with you. See what they do to you next, right? The slavery, the tragic experiment of slavery in American history, the massive blemish upon our history, has nothing to do with what we're seeing here. Though tragically, throughout the history of the church, Christians have often looked back into the stories of the Bible and found references to slavery here and there, taking them out of context to justify their enslavement of their fellow man. There couldn't be anything more contrary to the story of the Bible. Look at what happens here. Abram has 318 men that he got off the slave block in Haran and in Egypt. They go out with him to war. What slave master in Alabama could expect his servants, his slaves, to go out in war with him? What would happen there? Well, he'd be the first one dead, right? And then they'd all flee, running wherever they want to go, right? Because there you have abuse of fellow man. Here's something else is going on. God has, through Abram, already begun to build the people of God. Who are they? Former slaves, led by Abram. In the book of Exodus, it's going to be led by Moses, right? This is a type of the very people of Egypt, whom God will, the people of Israel who are in Egypt. The Israelites were slaves in Egypt. And so just, now what happens to these people? They become part of the people of God. They're going to all be circumcised and become part of the people of Israel. We don't know their descendancy or their tribes because they're just from all over the place. These are people who come from, these are maybe indentured slaves. These are people who have been in slavery for generation and generation. They were picked up in Haran. They are picked up in Egypt. Who knows what their ethnic background is? The author isn't concerned. Who knows if anyone would have known? Even they might not have known. But they end up being all circumcised, we're going to see, and become part of the people of God, mixed in with them, right? This is the story that we'll see later on, of course, of the people of Israel and also the Gentiles coming in. Okay, so the kinsmen, or the 318 servants, they go out with him. They obviously trust him, and he trusts them. And they go out, and they risk their lives for their father in the faith, Abram. Then it says that when he comes back from battle, that Melchizedek, king of Salem, comes out to meet him. Melchizedek, king of Salem. Melchizedek, this is a throne name. This is not what he was named when he was born. Melchizedek, Melchizedek, king of righteousness, righteous king. He's the king of Salem. Kings in the ancient world had throne names. Whatever their name was when they were born, who knows? But we know their throne name. Let me give you some other examples in the Old Testament. Adonai Zedek, another king of Jerusalem. The Jebusite king of Jerusalem, Adonai Zedek. Right? Adonai, our Lord the King. Our Lord of Righteousness, Adonai Zedek. Or Ahimelech. Ahimelech, you probably have heard that name, right? This is my brother or brother king. Et cetera, et cetera. These are throne names. Melchizedek, king of righteousness. He's the king of Salem. Where is Salem? According to the Jewish tradition, this is Jerusalem. Jerusalem. It will be called Jerusalem later on. But at this stage, it's still just called Salem. Salem. There are other cities in the ancient area, in the region, in the ancient world called Salem. But according to the Jewish tradition, he is the king of Salem that will become Jerusalem. According to the Jewish tradition as well, and as we hear according to St. Ephraim, the Syrian, he is Shem, the eldest son of Noah. Now, how could that be? Shem, according to the genealogy, and the last we've heard of him, would still be alive if you work out your timing of who's born and how long they live. Shem's still alive. In fact, he's going to outlive Abraham, according to how long he lives in the book of Genesis. And according to the rabbinic tradition, according also is St. Ephraim, who gives this to us, that Shem is an important character in the story because he's going to pass on the blessing to the people of God. He's going to pass on the blessing to Abram. That blessing was received from Noah earlier in the book. Right? He's taking care of protecting the righteous line and keeping them from the wicked. This is by dwelling in Jerusalem. If you want to read more on that, you can read St. Ephraim's commentary on Genesis. All right, so Melchizedek comes out, and he offers up bread and wine. And Abram gives a tenth of all that he has to him. In some commentaries, modern commentaries, you'll hear something like this. Who's Melchizedek? Well, he's the king of Salem. This is the region, the Jebusites. And so he's a pagan priest who, early in the history of the people of Israel, the Israelites were still, you know, polytheists and monotheists mixed in. They eventually became more monotheistic, but originally polytheists. And so this is a story from early in their history when they were still polytheistic and worshiping the gods of Jebusites. And that doesn't make any sense at all in the story. That doesn't make any sense at all in the story. If that is the case, a later author would have easily edited this thing out, okay? Furthermore, it ignores the fact of how central the Melchizedek story is to the entire book. It ignores the fact that Melchizedek is going to be mentioned later on in Psalm 110. It ignores the fact of how important Melchizedek is in the New Testament. Melchizedek, whether you know you believe he's Shem or not, isn't of too great importance here. I would think that makes a lot of sense out of the story. But whatever the case may be, he's the king of Salem, and that's important. And he offers up bread and wine. And Abram recognizes him as the priest of the God that Abram worships. It says, Melchizedek came forth. It says, he was priest of God Most High. Not any old God, but God Most High. And he said, blessed be Abram by God Most High, that is the God I worship, maker of heaven and earth. Remember Genesis 1, right? In the beginning, the heavens, God made the heavens, the earth. Genesis 2 as well. Blessed be God Most High, who has delivered you from into your hand. Look at the next verse. And Abram gave him a tenth of everything. And the king of Sodom said to Abram, give me the persons, that, but you can keep the rest. And he said, no. He said, I have sworn by God Most High, Yahweh God Most High. Right? So now we hear clearly that the God of Abram is the same God as the one that is worshipped by Melchizedek. Which again makes a lot of sense out of the story of Shem and the story of Noah back then when we saw him being blessed by Yahweh in an episode. All right. Whatever the case may be, again, we're going to see this story of Melchizedek come up again in Psalm 110 or Psalm 109, depending on how you want to count them. When David will identify his descendancy as having the priesthood of Melchizedek. Why is that? Because they're going to inherit the throne of Melchizedek, Jerusalem. We're going to see David wearing a linen ephod, Solomon doing the same thing, offering up sacrifices, not usurping or trying to displace the priesthood of Aaron, but a different priesthood. This is a kingly priesthood. And this is important in the New Testament. This is why we see Jesus at the Last Supper offering up as the Christ, as the King of Jerusalem, offering up bread and wine. This is a major theme, of course, the Epistle to the Hebrews. More on that later. Chapter 15. After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. Fear not, Abram. I am your shield. Your reward shall be very great. But Abram said, O Lord, what wilt thou give me? For I continue childless, and the heir of my house is Eleazar of Damascus. All right, one of his servants. Now, he likes Eleazar. He trusts Eleazar. Eleazar trusts Abram like a father. They love each other. But Eleazar is not his son. And Abram desires to have a son. So again, you can see the Abram's treatment of these servants, these slaves, the fact they go out and battle for him. They obviously love him, they trust him, and he trusts them. Abram's here tells us that he has no sons, so the eldest of his household, Eleazar, shall be the inheritor of his wealth. Fine, but that's not what he would prefer. He'd like to have his own son, his own genetic son. I don't think we could fault him here. We're going to see later on in taking Eleazar and sending him away with some camels to go get Rebekah for Isaac, right? What servant who's being mistreated by their master could you give a load of camels with all this wealth and say, now go away and come back with somebody for a wife for my son? And he'd never show up again. But Eleazar does, because Eleazar is in covenantal relationship with Abram, his covenantal father, right? His father in the faith. All right. So Abram said, behold, thou hast given me no offspring, and a slave born in my house will be my heir. Behold, the word of the Lord came to him, this man shall not be your heir. Your own son shall be your heir. And he brought him outside and said, look toward the heaven and number the stars if you are able to number them. Then he said to him, so shall your descendants be. And he believed Yahweh, and he reckoned it to him as righteousness. Now, what's going on here? There are two times in the day when a man is in his tent in the Middle East, in this period and region. In the heat of the day, in the middle of the day, when it's blazing hot, after you've been working in the early morning, it starts to get hot, and you go into the tent, you get some shade under a tree, you rest, you eat, you take a nap. And then around 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, as the sun starts to go down, then you start to go out and you start to work again. You work until it's too dark. Well, if that's the case, then Abram is coming out of his tent in the middle of the day. Now, can you see any stars in the middle of the day? Well, he said, well, the sun's a star. Well, they weren't thinking like that. So, no, you can't see the stars in the middle of the day. And so, if that's the case, then what's going on here is Abram's being asked to believe in something that is going to take place that he cannot see, right? Faith is the hope of things unseen. We see this in the Epistle of Hebrews. The other possibility is that this is in the evening, early, early morning, before sunrise. Whatever happens, Abraham believed, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness. We're going to hear this come out in Romans. We're going to hear it come out in Galatians, in the Epistle to James, in the Epistle of James. Where Paul in Romans and Galatians is going to show that righteousness does not come by circumcision. Abraham's not circumcised yet. So how is it that Abraham can be righteous in this very important passage about the righteous Abraham, and yet he's not circumcised? As Paul shows, this proves that righteousness does not depend on circumcision. Why does he have to say this in the Epistle of Romans and the Epistle of Galatians? Because both of those epistles were written to communities that thought that circumcision actually meant something. That in the new covenant, you still had to be circumcised if you really wanted to be a full, real, serious Christian. Baptism, absolutely. But if you really want to, you know, you really want to be a full inheritor of the kingdom, you got to be circumcised and keep kosher. And so Paul shows clearly in those epistles, along with the kosher laws, these are things of the old covenant. All right, so then in verse 7, he said to him, I am the Lord who brought you forth from Ur the Chaldeans to give you this land to possess. But he said, O Lord God, how am I to know that I shall possess it? And he said to him, bring me a heifer, 3 years old, a she-goat, 3 years old. So he brings these animals, he cuts them in two. Now, if you look later on in the Old Testament, in Jeremiah chapter 34, we see a similar episode of men cutting a calf in two, making a covenant and walking through it between the two halves, which according to commentators indicates something like this, that the two cut walking through the animals cut in half, making a covenant, are promising that they would become like this dead animal cut in two if they break this covenant. What's interesting here is Abram doesn't have to walk through the animals. God comes down, we see, and moves through the animals in the form of the pillar of fire or pillar of cloud. We're going to see this in the Exodus later on. God covenants himself to Abram. But Abram at this point doesn't have to do anything. He just has to go along for the ride. That will change, of course, after this. You also get a theme here of waiting on the Lord. He's waiting. He's waiting. He's waiting. Vultures come down. He's chasing. He's waiting. Finally, the sun goes down. He's waiting. Then finally, God says to him, he says, know for certain that your descendants, this is verse 13, will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs. It will be slaves there, and they will be oppressed for 400 years. But I will bring judgment upon the nation they serve. Afterward, they will come out with great possession. This is, of course, the story of Egypt and the Exodus. Again, you can see how the book looks forward as a catechesis for those people. As for yourself, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried in a good old age. And they shall come back here in the fourth generation, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. Who are the Amorites? Well, the Amorites are a particular tribe of the descendancy of Ham. But that's not how it's being used here. Amorite like Canaanite will be used to mean the peoples of the land. Canaanite is a particular group of people, but we'll hear the land of Canaan, for example. Well, who's the land of Canaan? Well, there's tons of different peoples there, right? So the word Amorite here, the peoples of the land, the descendancy of Ham, who are dwelling there currently, their iniquity is not yet complete. So God is going to bring forth the people of Israel out of Egypt into the land of the promised land, which is the land of Israel, to punish the wickedness of the Amorites and to fulfill the promise to Abraham. We'll see this in Deuteronomy chapter 9 when we get there. Verse 17, the sun went down near the flaming smoking torch, goes through just like in the Exodus. Verse 18, on that day the Lord made a covenant with Abram. Made a covenant with him. And look at the land. He's promised the entire Fertile Crescent, from the Euphrates all the way to the Nile. The whole thing. It's all his. Now, they will only possess that land for a short time during the time of the life of Solomon. Chapter 16. This is a good spot to stop because this is connected, as far as we can tell, to chapter 17 and the rest of the book. So let's stop there at chapter 15, the end of chapter 15.